Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could you summon compassion for someone who tried to kill you? And how might that spirit of forgiveness change your life? Many North Texans will remember that in the weeks after 9/11, a gunman named Mark Stroman launched a bizarre quest for revenge by shooting workers at three area convenience stores because he believed them to be Arabs. Two of those shot died in the attacks. But a third, a recent immigrant from Bangladesh looking for a brighter future in the United States, survived a gunshot wound to the eye and over the course of a decade found a surprising path to healing his soul along with his body. Anand Giridharadas is a columnist for The New York Times. He tells the story in his new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Anand, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back on.
So I think this story brings back very sad memories for many people who were living in this part of the country just after 9/11. But for anybody who's moved here since then, will you remind us what happened in those attacks around Dallas in the fall of 2001?
Well, in Dallas and everywhere around the country was shocked. And we will all remember the reruns of the planes hitting into the towers over and over again, looped on the television news night after night, day after day. And in Dallas and in a few other places, there were a group of men, I think they were all men, who were particularly crazed by this. And in the case of Mark Stroman, came to the conclusion that this was unacceptable, that the government of the United States would not have the fortitude to deal with it, and that he, Mark Stroman, would have to take care of this himself. And so he decided to go in a one-man war on terror and drive to these three gas stations and shoot the brown-skinned man he found behind each of their counters.
Hmm. So your book ultimately centers on the one person who was shot by Mark Stroman in that spree but survived. And importantly, Raisuddin Buyan, and please correct my pronunciation if necessary, was and is a person given to reinventing himself throughout his life.
He is. And this is a country, as we so often say in this casual phrase, a nation of immigrants. But part of what that means in practice is an extraordinary percentage of Americans, more than in most places, is descended from people sort of with the spirit that I found in Raisuddin Buyan, who goes by Race for short, which is a spirit of, as you say, reinvention. And in Race's case, that meant growing up in Bangladesh, large family, a lot of siblings, and having this sense from a very young age, long before he contemplated America, that he was special, that his destiny was special, and that the rules that applied to others wouldn't apply to him, and that he had to serve more and do more and achieve more. And that led to him getting into the Air Force in his country and being an Air Force officer. And then it led to him saying, you know what, I want something even more than that, though that was a very prestigious post. And that more was America, came to New York. And North Texans will be happy to hear that after a couple years in New York, he visited Dallas and came to the conclusion that Dallas is really paradise compared to this New York, which is kind of crowded and very cramped, a bit like Bangladesh. But Dallas has, you know, bathrooms as big as my bedroom in New York, and I'm gonna move there. Hmm. And so he moves there in fulfillment of yet another one of these dreams. And he's working in a convenience store in eastern Dallas. Not a great place, a lot of crime. He's robbed himself a couple times that summer of 2001. But the future that he imagines, this wedding that's going to happen in a couple months, this IT class he's going to start taking at either UTD or Richmond, it's all so real to him that he's able to kind of drown out the immediate tedium of selling three tamales for a dollar to people and persevere. And then on September 21st, a man walks in, says, "Where are you from?" and shoots him in the eye.
Hmm. What's so striking about that is that because Race had been robbed working in the store already a couple of times, initially Mark Stroman walks in and his thought is, oh, great, this guy's here to hold me up, but doesn't quite realize how much danger he's in.
He doesn't. And there was a robbing incident, I think a couple, few weeks before that, in which a man had walked in, bought, I think, a soda, given Race a dollar, and then held a gun into the air. And because it was this kind of poor neighborhood, Race had grown accustomed to a lot of people coming in and bringing all kinds of things that you don't normally think of selling to sell to the gas station. And the gas station sometimes bought this stuff from people. It was like a little pawn shop. And so he actually assumed that the guy robbing him was selling him the gun. And it took the gun being cocked, that first robbing, for him to realize this is not a sale. And then, again, he thought on September 21st, 2001, I'm being robbed and this is quite an irritation and let me just give the guy the money. But that time, unfortunately, the man didn't want any money.
Tell us about his injuries.
He was fortunate in that the other two people were shot by kind of conventional bullets that essentially killed them at once. Mm-hmm. And in Race's case, for reasons that were never entirely clear, Mark Stroman changed his gun and used a Derringer pistol and a shot that kind of sprayed birdshot into Race's face. I think something like 36 pellets remain in his face to this day. And some of them, I think two, perforated the eye and stopped millimeters behind the eye from the entrance to the brain. So he could have had very severe brain damage. What did happen was most of the sight in his right eye was lost over a period of time where he tried to revive it through surgeries. And so he's effectively blind in his right eye. But he sort of miraculously survived. And in some ways, it seemed to him yet another piece of luck, from the visa he got on the eighth try to getting into the Air Force to getting to America. And over time, that luck of surviving kept haunting him, and he wondered, why did I survive, as many people who survive such a thing do. And over the years, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, he came to a very unexpected conclusion about what God's salvation of him required of him, an act of salvation that it required from him in turn.
What I love, Anand, about Race's idea about himself and about why he was special and the ways that he had been treated in special ways by God or the universe is that, you know, there's two ways of looking at it, right? You can look at it like, oh, I was shot in the eye and I'm lucky to have survived. Or you can look at the other side and say, I was shot in the eye. You can say, I got my visa on the eighth try and finally I'm in America. Or you can say, it took me eight tries to get my visa. And it seems like he is just relentlessly positive throughout his life.
He is. And one of the interesting things, you know, I spent time with him over 3 years to write this book. And one of the interesting things about him is, if you were to put that question to him, I think he would say, it's because of my faith in God and I'm able to see this higher mission. But the reality is, a lot of people believe in God and don't have that disposition.
Right.
And I think part of what makes him such a fascinating character to me and led me to write a book about this rather than, you know, a column, is that there's something both deeply of the old world and of his Islamic faith in him, and something profoundly American in him. This optimism almost in spite of all reality. And I think, you know, in some ways, one of the best and sometimes worst traits that we associate with this American spirit is being a little bit willfully oblivious to reality. But that's what allows this country over and over again to do things that everybody else would say is impossible. And he has that. And I don't know where he got it, but he certainly has it.
We do run the risk here of making it sound like he just bounced back immediately. In fact, it was a hard road to physical recovery. He also had some, what sounds like PTSD in the aftermath of all this.
Absolutely. And so the things I have been saying really do reflect a reality 10 years and more after the shooting. So let's go back. He was shot. He is rushed to the ER. On the next day, the very next day, with his right eye still shut and caked with blood, with pellets all over his face, his mouth barely able to move, barely able to talk without it causing immense pain, he is discharged from the hospital because, apparently being shot in the face was a pre-existing condition. And he's now out on the street. He's, you know, taken back to his friend's house who owned the gas station. But eventually that friend gets tired of taking care of a guy who doesn't really generate a lot of revenue anymore. He's sort of homeless for a period. He's begging for medical samples, and he's very clearly depressed. And he said something to me once which really captured for me the depth of how afraid he was. He said, you know, I was constantly afraid for years that a member of Mark Stroman's association would come and get me. Now, as far as anybody knows, Mark Stroman didn't have any formal association. He was kind of a lone wolf. But he had these tattoos all over himself, and he claimed all these kind of allegiances. And I think in Race's mind, he had to be part of something larger to do this. And Race was always wondering who else might be out there that is part of this same cause. So he slowly recovered, stayed indoors, ordered computer programming textbooks online and read them by himself in the house so he wouldn't have to escape outdoors. And slowly, from that point, worked his way up the American ladder. And this started to become a story of, as you say, American reinvention. And one step along that path was an amazing period he had working at the Olive Garden.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. My guest is Anand Giridharadas. His new book is called The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We also hope that you will take the time today to become a supporting member of KERA online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. When you do, if you make a contribution of $120 or more, we would love to send you a thank you gift copy of Anand Giridharadas' new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. I'm joined now by our own Lauren Silverman, reporter here for KERA. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
And I'm happy to be in here because I have a whole bunch of goodies to offer people.
Excellent.
For giving to KERA. And I just see here that if you make your pledge today, you can win tickets to see Aretha Franklin.
Ooh.
Which sounds
phenomenal. Amazing.
And that's live at the Winspear Opera House on September 6th. So anyone who actually calls and donates today, 1-888-694-6931, will be put into that drawing, and the deadline is going to be tomorrow. The drawing is going to be at 9 a.m. tomorrow, and it is orchestra tickets to see the Queen of Soul.
Sounds fantastic. And of course, you will be paying for another great year of radio. You will be supporting local programming like Think. You will be supporting all the wonderful coverage you hear from our award-winning news team here in North Texas, and you will be supporting the national and global coverage that you get from NPR.
That's right. And I mean, what could be better than getting a gift and supporting public radio and the conversations that, like you're having today, fascinating, fascinating conversations. So there's also a challenge why we're trying to get you to call in or go on to KERA.org today. And that's because we have a new challenge which will give us extra dollars for your dollar. So you're giving more power to your pocketbook, I guess you could say. The Jim Lehrer Roundtable member from Dallas has reissued this challenge to encourage 250 listeners to make a donation today. So what they're offering is $2,000. They're going to give us $2,000 more if, but this is only if, 250 people call or go online to KERA.org with contributions by 4 p.m. So what is it? 12:20 now. We have a little bit of time for people to call. So far, I think we have 211 to go. So please be one of those 211 people so we can get an extra $2,000. The number to call is 888-694-6931, or you can go online to KERA.org.
I know there are many of you listening who are not yet members who try to never miss this show, who plan lunch around it. If you really feel like this is part of your daily radio diet, your daily information diet, now is the perfect time to make a contribution at KERA.org or at 888-694-6931. You can choose a thank you gift. You may very well win tickets to see Aretha Franklin. And of course, you will become a patron of quality news and information on KERA. KERA.org to make a contribution or 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York Times reporter Anand Giridharadas about his new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Okay, Anand, I'd like to talk about Mark Stroman. What kind of family background did he have? What kind of criminal history did he have before he launched what, you know, was really a twisted plot for revenge following 9/11?
Mark Stroman, in many ways, is an embodiment, a product of something that's getting a lot of kind of attention these days from in the press and sociologists, a white working class in America that seems to be kind of worse off this generation than in past generations. And he grew out of that world, kind of in and around Dallas, grew up a little bit in Plano or around Old Siegelville Road at times and bounced around the city. And from a very early age was a troubled child. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, there were kind of very bad nightmares from the time he was quite young. He starts to get into, you know, minor run-ins with the law, stealing a guy's truck for a few hours, you know, shooting a slingshot at someone, you know, nunchucks being kind of deployed at someone, and starts to get arrested for stealing and living in vacant apartments. And it escalates to the point that, you know, in around 1990, when he's kind of in his late teens, early 20s, he goes to jail for is sentenced to years-long stints and each time serves only a few months before getting out thanks to overcrowding. And sort of comes out of that an angry young man, in and out of drugs, in and out of meth, which was, as you know, starting to do the rounds in these parts, and struggling to form attachments, you know, getting married, that not working, trying to get married again, that not working, having kids, seeing them three times a year for special occasions, if that, in many ways represented this kind of precarious life that actually a lot of people are struggling with these days. But Mark Stroman clearly had additional problems that a lot of people are not struggling with and sometimes got into these drug binges, which he claimed to be on at the time of these attacks. And it was never entirely clear, though, what actually went wrong that month, because he'd kind of done pretty minor things relative to going to three gas stations and shooting someone.
Yeah. What explanation did he give? Because he did a lot of talking after the fact. What explanation did he give for why he carried out these attacks and what he expected to come of them?
You know, someone I know who knows quite a bit about terrorism made an interesting point the other day after I read him some of a manifesto Stroman wrote answering your question, and this kind of terrorism expert said to me, this is the exact same rhetorical argument of Osama bin Laden, but in reverse. And so my answer to your question is part of his argument in this manifesto he wrote and elsewhere was it was kind of a mashup of a bunch of different grievances. But at the heart of it was we want those people to feel the same sense of chaos living here that they live in over there, which, you know, may or may not make a lot of sense. We feel aggrieved that we as Americans have helped their countries and given them foreign aid and taken care of them when they were hungry and all of that. And now here they are standing behind our gas station counters bombing our buildings. Now, never mind that those are a lot of different people we're talking about and not all of them were responsible for the same things. But there was this sense more generally of, as I say, kind of an angry white guy who felt that minorities and immigrants and distant foreigners were kind of nibbling away at this great little American platform he was standing on. And that platform was getting smaller and smaller. And these 9/11 attacks were not a one-off thing. They were the culmination of something he had kind of felt besieged by for a long time. And now it was time for him to act.
There was a question, I suppose, about whether to characterize this as a hate crime or simply as capital murder, and there were interesting implications there for the punishment that Stroman would receive either way.
Yes. As I don't know if the law has changed now, but back then, as far as I was able to to understand it from my reporting, there was to get the death penalty, you had to be and still now convicted of capital murder, which is essentially murder committed while committing one of a small handful of other crimes like arson or robbery or I think rape. And if you do not commit another crime while committing murder, you actually can't get capital murder. And the prosecution was very determined to be able to try Mark Stroman and get him the death penalty. And I think a lot of that came, they were very transparent in the trial. They apologized to the jury for having kind of arrested and let him go and convicted and let him go so many times since he was, you know, probably not even shaving yet. And they were determined this time to only deal with him one more time and by killing him. And in order to do that, they had to establish that he was committing another crime while robbing, while going to these gas stations. And they sort of pushed this idea that he was robbing them. The problem with the theory was he never took money in any of the cases. In two of the cases, he didn't even ask for money. But he doomed himself in one of the robberies of a Shell station by saying, "Give me the money," and fiddling with the register. He never took money in the end. But by saying that, they were able to argue that this was not a hate crime, which actually would have been difficult to try him for capital murder on. This was robbery murder, simple robbery murder, not an ideological crime, and therefore we can charge him with death.
We should note that he was not tried for trying to kill Race because prosecutors wanted to go for the maximum penalty and sentence for him.
Absolutely. And so he was tried for that single shooting where the man at the Shell station, Vasudev Patel, where he died and where he had said, "Give me the money." And those four words are the reason that he ended up getting the death sentence applied to him in the trial in 2002.
All right, so let's go back to Race, who is sort of coming along throughout this time, doing some studying at home, gets a job, of all places, at the Olive Garden as a waiter. Why was that so transformative for him?
Well, he's sitting at home, studying, terrified of everybody outside. And as a new immigrant, you have to remember, he hasn't been here a while. And so his sociological understanding of who it was that did this to him is pretty limited. And so he's kind of omnidirectionally afraid. And he finally comes to the conclusion that he needs to get back out there into society and confront all kinds of people. So he stops being afraid of all these people. And he thinks, where can I do that? Where can I get a job that'll be safe in a public place but give me a lot of contact with people? And he figures out a restaurant may be a good idea. And, you know, and as I sometimes joke to him, if you are going to try to get over your fear of white people, the Olive Garden may not be the worst choice. And so he got a job as a server at the Olive Garden. And, you know, he didn't know how to do that, never done it before. But it was just one more thing to learn, and he did it, another reinvention, until he learned that in America, at a restaurant like the Olive Garden, half or more of a server's tips sometimes come from alcohol. And Race didn't drink alcohol, didn't really want to deal with alcohol, and was, you know, if he was going to have that view, lose out on half of his potential salary. So he first kind of convinced himself that, you know, God doesn't want me to die, so I should probably, you know, serve this alcohol as long as I'm not having it myself. And then he kind of got a little good at it. If you're gonna do this, you might as well be good at it. And memorized a bunch of descriptions. Started telling people if the wines were, as you put it, crispy, chocolatey, or spicy. And in some months, became the highest-grossing alcohol seller at the Olive Garden in Mesquite.
So, you know, what's really amazing about Race is that you would think that after, you know, living in Dallas for, what was it, 3 or 4 months before he was attacked, that it would be so easy to blame this country and to just go back home. Did that plan of action ever occur to him?
It did not. It occurred to everybody else who knew him.
Yeah.
Who were absolutely beside themselves and kind of shocked that this guy would not go home, or at least leave Texas, go back to New York. But Race was, as I've said, an extremely determined guy. He had chosen Texas. He had set his mind on succeeding there. And remarkably enough, he treated being shot in the eye as a speed bump rather than a stop sign. And he decided that I have to do this. For some period, he actually could not fly for medical reasons. So he had that excuse to give his family. But then that excuse lifted. And he still stuck there and wanted to continue. And he said, you know, the kind of background I have as a fighter pilot and a fighter for my own achievements does not allow me to give up on my goals. I will go back home. I will recover. I will be surrounded by family, but I will feel like I'm a loser for the rest of my life. And I can't bear that.
How did he decide to go to Mecca with his mother? And how did that pilgrimage literally change his life?
It did change his life. Many of your listeners will know that there are five sacred duties in Islam for devotees, and only one of them, as I understand it, is optional, and that is the pilgrimage to Mecca. It is optional because it costs, you know, quite a bit of money, and not everybody in the world can afford to go to Saudi Arabia for a pilgrimage. And in fact, there's some debate about this within the faith, but there is a view that you should not go if you're in debt. And Reis was on the conservative side of that argument, and he felt you should absolutely not go if you're in debt, because it's sort of like avoiding your debt by using God as your alibi.
Right.
And he was, by, you know, for most of the 2000s after the shooting, about $60,000 in debt. Because of his medical bills, because of being kicked out of that hospital and then treated as an outpatient, and couldn't go, but had always wanted to go on this pilgrimage and had promised his mother. Finally, he gets a grant from the Texas, state of Texas, kind of victims' rights program, and is able to go on this pilgrimage. And from the moment he gets to Mecca, and this is a very overwhelming experience. Some of your listeners may have seen photographs of this, just extraordinary crowds, mostly dressed in white, swirling around the central black cube of the Kaaba. And as soon as he gets there, he has this very strong feeling that this is a before and after moment in his life. And he's not sure why. And just as the shooting was a before and after moment, he felt that God was trying to tell him something again, was kind of tapping on his shoulder and telling him to pay attention. And it took him time to figure out what exactly the message was. But by the end of that month in Mecca, he kind of got a broken nose and felt that was, again, another little sign from God. At the end of that month, he became very clear that when he was dying, as he thought it was in 2001, he had looked to the sky and said to God, "If you save me, I will dedicate the rest of my life to serving others." And then for 8 years, had not really been able to do that because he had to rebuild his own life. And what he realized in Mecca was that now was time. It was time to repay God for saving him. And now he had to go back to Texas, and he did, and spent a year thinking about how do I, one single solitary individual, a Bangladeshi, now turned American citizen, how do I repay God? And the conclusion he came to was utterly extraordinary.
We'll talk about that conclusion in just a couple of minutes with journalist Anangir Dardas, who is the author of the new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. If you would like to read Anand's book and also support KERA at the level of $10 a month or above, you can do that now. We have it available as a thank you gift at 1-888-694-6931 and at kera.org. Your contribution helps us to bring you really compelling interviews like this one, stories that speak to the fabric of life in America, the good and the bad and everything in between. Your contribution pays for these driveway moments that you have. 888-694-6931 or kera.org. Hello again, Lauren.
Hello again.
Lauren Silverman is here.
As always, another wonderful hour of Think. And we have people who've been calling in during the Think show, Think fans and just fans probably of KERA's programming in general. So a few people to thank real quick. We have a Miss Summer, Miss Summer Baggett in Louisville, Joel Mc Endry, I hope I'm saying that right, from Colleyville. You get to do this a lot more than I do, so you can probably read names.
I get to butcher names
you
more
get to
often
butcher names
you.
More than I do. And Stephen Jalal, I think, in Garland. So those are a few people who've called in. You can join this list of names as people who are part of the KERA team, really. It's a family, a big family, and we want to grow it. So call us at 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org.
Your contribution puts good radio out there, not just for you, but for the entire North Texas community. It can be exceptionally affordable if you do this on the sustaining membership plan. Just a few dollars a month, or as many dollars as you'd like a month, from your checking account or your debit or credit account goes straight into the KERA membership account. I mean, many people can do $20, $30, even $50 without really even noticing it. And if you want to make a friends level contribution, $1,500, that breaks down to just $125 a month. Think about it now at KERA.org or 888-694-6931.
And there are other incentives to become a sustaining member. If you do a $20 a month sustainer, you can show your love for KERA with a t-shirt, which actually you get three things. You get a t-shirt that says KERA green on it, and you also get an iced coffee cup, which is good timing right now, I would say, and two reusable KERA shopping bags in royal blue with the KERA logo. So that's for $20 a month. You can both get some goodies to show your love for KERA and for the public radio programming that you hear, as well as get some fun things to show off for the summer.
I would love to see somebody in the grocery store wearing their KERA t-shirt, holding their blue bags and drinking from their iced coffee mug. And I will go up and I will shake. I will give you a hug if I see you out there.
It will be an instant hit on Twitter and Instagram. I'll tell you that much.
Especially if Justin Martin finds you.
Yes.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number to make your contribution, or you can do it online at KERA.org. We are still putting people into the drawing for these Aretha Franklin tickets. I believe we're going to pick the winner tomorrow morning. Yep. So if you make your contribution now, you will be in that drawing. You can choose a thank you gift if you're interested. And of course, we have this challenge going, $2,000 extra to the station if we can have a total of 250 contributions by 4 o'clock today. Your contribution right now or in the evening if you're listening to the rebroadcast, I want to keep you guys in mind as well, will help KERA remain strong. So please do it now at KERA.org or 888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Anand Giridharadas.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas. His new book is called The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Anand, before the break, you sort of set us up for the remarkable decision made by Reyes Buyan. And once he made it, he never turned back.
He did not. What he felt, as I was saying, was that he came to the conclusion that God hadn't saved him for nothing. That God had saved him because there must be something that he can do for humanity in repayment. And he came back to Dallas, thought about it for a year, searched online, networked as much as he could around different kinds of gatherings and peace conferences and various things, and finally came to the conclusion that of all the things that pained him in the world, the cycle of enmity and mistrust between the United States and the West more generally and his Islamic faith most pained him. Because, to be frank, he loved Islam and he loved America. Mm. And he didn't understand. It's like when two of your friends don't get along, you don't understand, you know, what the problem is. And he wanted to intervene in that cycle of mistrust. And he thought, my way of doing that is going to be to publicly forgive this man who shot me. And more than that, I am going to fight a campaign against the state of Texas, against Governor Perry in the courts and in the media, to save my attacker from death row.
he found his motivation for that clemency campaign within his faith. And that might surprise some people who unfortunately have had their views of Islam skewed by the actions of a minority of extremists. Can you talk about what Reis found specifically within Islam to tell him that this was the way to proceed?
In Islam, as well as in Christianity and just about every other religion that I've come across, there's actually quite a bit of airtime given to the notion of mercy.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually look at the texts, it's certainly true of the Bible, and it's certainly true of the Quran. In fact, the famous eye for an eye passage in the Quran, which, you know, everybody knows, is followed within the same sentence or in the very next sentence by, you know, something along the lines of, but if you forgive, you're even better. But that airtime, in terms of kind of space in the text, never translates into airtime of practice these days. And the kind of revenge tradition has really in modern times come to be much more dominant than the mercy tradition. And so what Reis wanted to do was say, there is at the core of my understanding of Islam a notion of mercy. God is merciful to us, and we must be merciful to others. And he constantly talked about how the same was true of the Christian faith, and decided that he didn't just want to forgive this guy and say, hey, no hard feelings. He wanted to forgive him in a way where he showed that he understood that there was something wrong in the society more generally that had produced Mark Stroman, in a kind of undernation that had produced him, that was failing a lot of people. Most of those people didn't go out and do something terrible like Mark Stroman did, but there were a lot of people besides Mark Stroman who were hurting and bitter and resentful and lashing out in one of many ways. And Reis wanted to, in a way, reach all of them and create an opportunity for healing in his adopted country more generally by saying, I never hated this man who hated me, and I forgive him, and I now want to fight with him to combat hatred and ignorance in others.
How did Reis acknowledge the suffering of the survivors of the other two victims who didn't live after they were shot by Mark Stroman?
Reis was determined to not to pursue this campaign of mercy and not to fight to get Stroman off death row unless he had the support of the other two families.
Mm-hmm.
One family seems to have given its support quietly and only to him. They never said anything publicly, but I know for a fact that they remain friends and he often visits the widow, so it couldn't have been, you know, it couldn't have been conflictual. The other family, the Hassan family, was explicitly and outwardly, I think even wrote a letter supporting the campaign, again, out of the notion that it would be good for America and good for Islam and good for everyone to show this other side of the faith that people don't know a lot about, this notion of mercy.
What happened when Reis and Stroman actually met?
Well, they never met
or spoke
in the flesh again. So the first and only kind of in-person meeting was that unfortunate one in the store. And then Stroman sentenced to death, gets an execution date in July 2011. And shortly before that, Reis files a lawsuit against Governor Perry, who at that very moment, you will recall, was just about to enter the presidential fray, and argues for Stroman's clemency. And on the final day of the scheduled execution, there's still a court hearing that's going to happen right around the time of the execution. And Reis is going to be, and it's a real-life courtroom thriller, Reis is going to be on the stand testifying while they wait to decide whether to put those chemicals into Stroman's arm or not, depending on what Reis says. But right before that, Reis gets the opportunity to speak to Stroman on the phone, sort of by chance. He calls another guy who happens to be on the phone with Stroman, and they put each other on. And they have an extraordinary kind of last-minute conversation that I'm happy to read the transcript of if it's helpful.
Yeah, I would love it if you would read it. It's a relatively short thing.
You know, and as I look for it, what was amazing about it is you never prepare for a moment like this. In some ways, he'd been waiting to talk to him the whole time. He needed to talk to him to come to his own healing. Race did. But then suddenly he's on the phone, and here's what happens. Mark says, "Race, how are you doing, Race?" Race says, "Hey, Mark, how are you, buddy?" Mark says, "How are you doing, man? Hey, man, thank you for everything you have been trying to do for me. You are inspiring. Thank you from my heart, dude." Race says, "Mark, you should know that I am praying for God, the most compassionate and gracious. I forgive you, and I do not hate you. I never hated you." Mark says, "You are inspired, Race." Race says, "And this is from the bottom of my heart." Mark says, "You are a remarkable person. Thank you from my heart. I love you, bro. I love you with all my heart. Thank you for being such an awesome person. I mean it." Race says, "You will always be there." Mark says, "You touched my heart. I would have never expected this." Race says, "You touched mine, too." Mark says, "Hey, Race, they are telling me to hang up now. I will try to call in a minute." But Mark never called back.
He was, of course, executed by the state of Texas. Did he ever formally apologize to Race?
He did, you know, in not in that conversation, but in a way he already had through a variety of blog posts and other messages that he had sent. And more than simply apologize, he had over time, after first vigorously defending what he did and calling himself an allied combatant, which is kind of his inversion of the enemy combatants whom the United States claimed to be fighting. Over the years, through the solitude of death row and through the entry into his life of a bunch of much better influences, prison ministers and other people, than any of the influences he'd had prior, he actually became a somewhat better guy and a more reflective guy and started to come to some understanding of what had gone wrong with him and how starved he had been of love as a boy, and that the abuse that he claimed to have suffered, the neglect, the abandonment, had kind of left this permanent hole which he sought to fill by, I guess, carving holes in others.
What's Race up to these days?
He is, as ever, still thriving, still marching on. He still works at a kind of internet travel company. He runs a group of kind of server and database server workers. He's a kind of senior manager and runs a team. I think nowadays his entire team is in Austria, and he's a kind of Bangladeshi American based in Texas managing a team in Austria.
That is so American. It's not even funny that
it is. And he's in a way a symbol of the world that is working. And that sounds funny to say in this story, because a casual listener will say, it doesn't sound like it worked great for him. But the crazy reality of the story is, you have a man who was shot in the eye shortly after getting to this country, and he will tell you that he feels he belongs to an America that actually still works, and where the American dream still holds true, and where upward mobility is still possible. And he will tell you that what he learned about Mark Stroman and Mark Stroman's children from entering their world was that they belong to an America that doesn't work anymore. And that what happened in that shooting was actually the collision between a failing country and a thriving country that still are very much with us and often keep separate, but on that one rainy day on September 21st, 2001, kind of brutally collided.
Anand Giridharadas is a columnist for The New York Times. His new book is called The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Anand, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate your attention to the show. We also appreciate your contributions at 888-694-6931 and at kera.org. We are working on a challenge. We have 205 contributions left to go in order to receive an additional $2,000 contribution to this nonprofit radio station, which is funded by listeners like you. You can support your public radio station now at kera.org. Lawrence, Silverman is back in the studio, back with a bang. Hi, Lauren.
Yeah, sorry about that. Scooting my chair around all over the place. Now, there's something interesting. I'm going to tell you a secret about Chris Boyd now. If you ever see the books that she goes through when she interviews an author, they look sort of like pinatas with the number of post-its and phenomenal research she does, which makes her interviews stand out in terms of being able to turn to whatever page in the book at any instant that she needs to. This is the kind of thoughtful planning and questions to create the questions that you hear on Think. So please call and support KERA and programs like Think by giving us a ring at 888-694-6931 or going online to kera.org.
You know, pinata would be nice. I could actually fill the books with candy after
there's
I'm
no
done.
Candy
there's
inside.
No candy, but there's great, great facts and,
yes,
and facts juicy information.
And
if you would like to be in this drawing for tickets to see Aretha Franklin, it's a pair of tickets. We're going to have a drawing tomorrow morning. When you call right now or go online, you're instantly entered, right? You make your contribution and you become a member of KERA or renew a membership, and you are automatically in that drawing. Even if you choose not to take a thank you gift, you've got a shot at these amazing tickets. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also do this online at kera.org. If you would like to read Anand Giridharadas' new book, The True American, which I have to say was really, really compelling, I would love to be able to send you a thank you gift copy, or our contribution team would, with a $10 a month level membership or above. The book is called The True American, and that's one of the thank you gifts we have.
And we have a few people to thank for calling in or going online in the past little while. Sandra Sage from Denton, Texas, Jennifer and Peter Eyestone from Dallas, and Karen Swenson from Dallas. We would love to hear from even more of you from across the area. We've got a lot of D's there. Maybe we could get some, maybe Fort Worth, maybe some other areas. If you are listening from a place with any city, really, we'd love to hear from you. Please call us and contribute to the programming that you hear, the interviews you hear, the music you hear, everything on KERA, and the national, international programming that we bring you on other shows. That number, again, is 888-694-6931, or you can go online to kera.org.
You know, public radio becomes like a way of life. Maybe you found your way to it and you were just, you know, looking around the dial for something interesting to listen to, and then you got drawn in, and then you started listening a little more, and then you were like, okay, every day at this time, I'm going to be by my radio. And then it became part of your commute and part of your routine. And pretty soon, you are not just a listener, you are a public radio person. And when you support the station financially, you are part of the public radio team, because we rely on your dollars to produce this programming. So make your contribution at kera.org or 888-694-693. You might choose to receive the leave no trace combo. It sounds like dangerous things are afoot. But in fact, it's a thank you gift that actually has five trees for a reforestation project planted in your honor. And we will also send you two reusable KERA shopping bags.
Although it sort of is leaving a trace, but in the best possible way,
right.
A mini forest trace.
Right. Leave no trash.
Leave no trash. Leave trees. You can leave trees, too, if you go online to kera.org and become a sustaining member for $10 a month. Or you can call us at 888-694-6931.
Everyone who is a member of the station right now was once not a member of the station. They were like you. They listened to these conversations and they heard the fundraising, and maybe they wished us well and they hoped that it would work out and assumed that someone else was going to do it. And then they had this little epiphany, this moment that said, okay, I can do this. I can become, a member at, we have sustaining memberships as low as $5 a month. And then once you do that, you can stop. You're not prohibited, but most people never do, because they realize how much value they get for that investment they make in KERA. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution at kera.org.